For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
On Debt, Sex, and Money, we feature interviews with you, our community of listeners, getting honest about uncomfortable things.
I developed an illness where it isn't safe for me to drive. A friend once said to me, sex is like air. You don't think about it until you're not getting enough. This is a similar sort of thing if you just replace sex with driving.
Listen to Debt, Sex, and Money wherever you get podcasts.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
Welcome to the XX Gabfest for Thursday, January 26th, the I Know What a Uterus Looks Like Now edition. I'm Hannah Rosen, a host of NPR's Invisibilia, and in the New York studios, we have June Thomas, editor of Outward, Slate's LGBTQ blog. Hi, June.
Hey, Hannah.
And Noreen Malone of New York Magazine. Hi, Noreen.
Hi, Hannah.
So our three topics today. First, the Women's March, the experience, the aftermath. Will it birth the left equivalent of the Tea Party? Second, why men don't take women's jobs, even when those are the only jobs around. We talked to a nurse who is a man. Note that I didn't say male nurse. Third, a recent poll of Americans shows that most people think it's a better time to be a man than a woman, with one exception, Republican men who say women have it better. We discuss. And then in our Slate Plus segment today, we are going to answer a reader question about armpit hair. And the question is it sexist to judge a woman with armpit hair in the workplace? So for Slate Plus members, we will talk about that at the end of the show. Our first topic, the Women's March. The numbers are disputed, but I was there. I know that it was something like 500,000 people. It seems about right. So let's talk about what it was like and how the left intends to harness its power. Now, Noreen, just from the little texting I did with you at the march, I didn't see you because there were 500,000 people there. It seemed like whatever resistance you had initially had mostly melted away. Is that right?
Well, yes. I mean, so I should I came on this podcast a few weeks ago and said I was not a marcher. I was a journalist. I didn't need to march. And I went to the march in my capacity as a journalist. Actually, I went to write about it. So that allowed me the distance that I sort of need in my soul. But I had a great time. I probably wrote with less critical distance than I should have because I just had a fantastic day where I felt good about being in a crowd of 500,000 other people who were deeply injured by the fact that Donald Trump is our president. And, you know, not all, but a lot of them were women. And the way I've been talking about it is that it was like the world's longest bathroom line. Like, you know, when you're waiting in line for the bathroom and you just kind of make friends with the woman beside you because you're doing the same thing. It was just like that easy camaraderie. And I thought a lot of the signs were really funny. There was a lot of energy. I had a good time. Count me not a skeptic anymore.
What was your experience, Hannah?
Oh, I thought it was amazing. I mean, it was amazing. It was chaotic. It was, as many people, you know, you'd hear people around you like, oh, this is more like a swarm than a march, or this is more like a meander than a march, because the technology didn't work. So there was not a lot of communication about go this way. In fact, one time we thought we were marching, and in fact, we were just online to the bathroom, just to complete your metaphor, Noreen.
But those were some long bathroom lines.
Yeah. I mean, the most amazing, I loved the signs so much. And I was thinking, what is 2017 about this march as opposed to the marches I went on when I was, you know, in college or post-college or in high school or whatever? And the difference to me was just the outpouring of kind of individuality and creativity. It was like a post-Etsy era march or something. There was so much craftiness and creativity in the signs. And it turned it, you know, I guess it's like selfie culture, like you want like a memorable image of you at the march and sort of your particular experience at the march. But the result of that was to turn the march into kind of old fashioned street theater. Like there was a sort of bread and puppet street theater element to the march, which made it just awesome. You know, usually, when I went to marches, you would just have words on a sign and everybody sort of had the same words, you know, or they would chant in unison. But this is like everyone doing their own thing. So the signs were unbelievable. And listeners, my friend Lori Leibovich has been collecting signs at hashtag nasty signs. Please post them on our Facebook page, the Double X Facebook page, if you have a sign or your favorite sign. I just can't get enough of them, or on our Twitter feed. They were just fantastic. They were so funny.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah, they were. I mean, they ran the gamut, right? People talking about climate change, people talking about Black Lives Matter, sort of traditional lefty issues of this moment. But there was a lot that was related to simply like being a woman. I think my favorite sign is I believe an Eileen Miles quote. I would call you a cunt, but you lack both warmth and depth. Directed at Donald Trump, I believe. That one was pretty good. A lot of them are filthy, by the way. Like, real filthy. There was a lot of riffing off of pop culture. There was one sort of older woman I saw carrying a sign with Kimmy Schmidt on it that says females are strong as hell, which is a reference to the theme song of Kimmy Schmidt.
So my role that day was kind of, you know, wrangling the live blog, and people were supposed to blog from the field. But of course, there was no cell connection. Mm-hmm. So I just had to grab things that I could see, which wasn't from people at the march, because everybody had the same problem at the various marches. Yeah. So I got a lot of stuff from around the world. And that was really incredible, because even when we got up at, like, you know, 7:30 a.m. on Saturday morning, there were photos of huge gatherings in Melbourne, in India, in London, in Zagreb. There were like this, and this kind of global aspect to the marches was really striking. And at least those guys had cell power.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that was the inspiring thing. It's like in Los Angeles, there are marches. In Berlin, there are marches. I mean, they were just everywhere. And also, women are awesome, I have to say, as marchers. Like, they're just awesome. It was like, you know, a kid would get lost and it's like a swarm of women would surround the kid, and immediately on the stage, like it would be like in the middle of Ashley Judd and whoever was talking, they would suddenly yell out, like, Caitlin is lost. If it's, you know, if your mom is there. It's just like, that's how you want a march to be. It was just like a big bundle of like raunchiness and supportiveness all at the same time.
Let's talk about how some people complained isn't the right word, but were uncomfortable that people had a good time.
It is an interesting criticism, because why wasn't there more anger? Mm. You know, there was a part of me that was like, why aren't people tearing down these fences? Like, it was a little too much of a, like, you know, love fest. Uh-huh. But I think that's okay if it gets carried on. Like, already women I know are sort of, let's get together and do this, and let's, like, just the sheer numbers seem to create a kind of momentum. But what do you think about, Noreen, the kind of goodwill bondingness versus the rage?
Well, so I've been thinking a lot about the size of these protests and the history of protests in America. And protest has always been kind of a radical thing in America, right? People who believe that we can change our norms, we can make them better, we don't have to just go along with what the status quo is. That is what pushes protests and change forward in this country, right? And maybe for the first time ever with this march, it wasn't those people protesting. It was sort of like the majority, right? The popular vote.
Right.
So if this is a movement, it's not exactly a movement to push norms. It's a movement to sort of keep norms where they are. And I felt like that was the behavior of people was sort of representative of that, right? It was sensible people protesting against a frankly angry and radical movement that is in power. And so in some ways, I think it's helpful that it matched that, right? Mm. That the tenor matched that. You know, it was a lot of older women. It was a lot of people who probably haven't done a lot of protesting in their lives. It was like NPR moms, which I can say because I have an NPR mom. And I hope that, Anna, you do not take offense to that. But you know what I mean. It's like,
wait, am I an NPR mom?
Well, you work at NPR.
I guess I'm. Yeah,
so you're doubly so.
Like
doubly
an Uber so. NPR mom.
Yeah, that's all I meant. It's not. But I guess if you have that many people and you're angry, that's a recipe for disaster. That's a recipe for bad news coverage. You know, I believe there was not a single protester arrested in all the protests around the world, which is extraordinary. And, you know, there are probably reasons of privilege why that is. But still, that is an extraordinary message to send, that sheer number of people doing peaceful protest. And the tradition of protest in this country, you know, nonviolent resistance, that is the core of it. And I think this was a beautiful expression of that.
So what do you think about the pussy uterus overflow of pussy and uterus?
Well, I was a skeptic about the pink pussy hats, which were everywhere. People got really into them as a knitting project. I think particularly, frankly, older women thought this was very funny. This sort of dirty joke that was an unflattering hat. You know, I think what I overheard one woman saying was that he, Donald Trump, you know, put the conversation on this level, that reducing women to a body part, and this was sort of reclaiming it, right? I know this offended some trans people, that, you know, the definition of woman has to do with, you know, whatever organs you have. As a message, I mean, I think one of the issues about this march that people have been saying is that it lacked a coherent message, right? That, you know, like just making signs about ovaries isn't necessarily starting a movement. To me, this was just like a group of people who are angry at Donald Trump, and everyone had their individual expression about why they were angry about Donald Trump. And, you know, it's an identity politics movement. Mm-hmm. And for a lot of these people, their major identification is as a woman. Their identification as an oppressed person is as a woman. And so they were expressing that via signs. And it turns out that you can make a lot of funny, dirty political jokes. I think that is what it boils down to.
Yeah.
What did you think, Hannah?
God, I have never figured out what my opinion is on the pussy uterus. Like, it was funny. And then somehow, after a while, like, the focus became reductive. It in a sense, it was the most unified thing at the march, was the hats. Like, that was, if there was a unified message, because as you said, some people were climate change, some people were making jokes, some people were deadly earnest, but the kind of pussy uterus theme was the thing that most consistently got carried through. I don't have a real problem with it. I mean, it's funny. It's a little like the vibe of the protest in general. It walks the line between dead earnest and ironic. You know, it's both funny, and it's a kind of free to be you and me era, kind of our bodies ourselves style message about reclaiming female sexuality. So I guess it's fine. Like, I don't have an objection to it. I got kind of overwhelmed by it in the moment. Just seeing thousands of pictures. Like, I know exactly what the uterus looks like. Like, the exact shape of the uterus. I will never, if I had to, you know, take a science test right now, I'd be all over it. Because I saw that so many times.
I have to say, as someone who was very, like you, Noreen, I was very skeptical about the pussy hats, but it was, as somebody who wasn't there, but who was trying to kind of make some observations about it, like, it was so useful. I mean, like, not everyone was wearing them, I bet neither of you wore them, but, you know, when you saw all, it was a sea of pink, and it was really, really useful. It was, and, you know, for all of the, I can see, you know, again, if you're talking strategy or tactics, that unity and unification and like getting a message might be useful. But this was a case where numbers were really important, partly because, again, of the freak in the White House who's obsessed with ratings and numbers, that it, because it was such a broad church, that's one of the reasons that there were so many people there. And that those getting those huge turnouts all over the world, that was really important. And if it had been more focused, there would have been more reasons for people to say, man, maybe not for me. Mm-hmm. And I think the broadness was really, really useful in many ways.
All right. So one other criticism of the march was that it was too white. That's a criticism that lingers. We are now going to talk to Kara Brown, who wrote an article in Jezebel called "I Want to Trust the Women's Marchers," in which she took this issue on. So, Kara, you wrote this article, "I Want to Trust the Women's Marchers." Tell me where, or tell us where your hesitation came from. Like, what was just kind of holding you back?
Well, when I went to the march in Los Angeles, and I found the day frustrating sort of from beginning to end. And part of it was just the logistics around it. It was really hard for me to get to the march. It was in downtown Los Angeles. When we got there, obviously, they had four times the amount of people that they thought there were going to be, so it was very crowded. But there was this other sort of nagging feeling that I had all day, and I was trying to figure out what it was. And it finally hit me early the next day when I was looking around at all of these people who had shown up for the march. And I definitely understand why this particular demonstration pulled the crowd and the response that it did. But it was hard not to wonder where these people had been for the past 9 months, for the past 2 years, or however long, particularly as, you know, Black Lives Matter has been much more active. They've been demonstrating a lot. You've had a lot of protests for Standing Rock. And just in general, lots of terrible things that happen all the time that people demonstrate for, that apparently this crowd didn't feel compelled to come out for.
Well, so what I would say to that, and I think you're completely right, it was, you know, it's a crowd of largely white women, and, you know, we have occupied a place of privilege for a long time, and we thought that, you know, America was like a pretty okay place, and the election of Donald Trump was a wake-up call for a lot of people, right? Sorry, guys, I just turned myself around. let me restart that sentence. You know, on the left right now, it is a movement of identity politics, and I think a lot of white women didn't think of themselves as really a, you know, a downtrodden class, which frankly, we aren't really, you know, that is a lot of white women, not all white women. There are a lot of poor white women in America. But I think, you know, what pulls people out to demonstrate is when they feel like their identity is under threat. And I think, frankly, for a lot of women, they didn't feel it before today, you know, and that's just a reality. That is in almost every movement, you know, whether it's gay rights or Black rights, it is largely driven by the people who feel that it is their own identity that is under threat.
But isn't that what you're complaining about, Kara? Like, you're saying that it was too long. Like, you have felt this, you know, anger, rage for a long time. And then, so why now? Like, why now is it that people are just coming out and realizing?
Yeah, it was that, and it was also, like I said, I'm very happy that the march happened. I'm glad that the number of people that showed up did. And, you know, I had a lot of really silly comments saying I was shaming protesters or something like that. And that's not what I was doing. I will say that I would like to challenge people to be better. And I think that if you can't handle that, frankly, I don't have a lot of faith in your ability to face Donald Trump and to face all of the things that we're about to face as a country. Because all I was saying was that I looked around at all of these people, and I hope that they keep showing up, and I hope that these are the people that, you know, are next to me the next time, you know, an unarmed Black person is shot. But I don't trust that because I haven't seen it before. And I really want them to, and, you know, it's not good, obviously, that Donald Trump is president, but if this is something that can really bring more people together and bring more people out, awesome. I just don't necessarily have that faith right now because that has not been the way things have gone ever before.
Yeah. Well, what would have, if you had gone to the march, is there anything, like, what would have, did it feel too, like you wrote it had this woohoo girl vibe.
Yeah.
Was that part of what you think was turning you off, the fact that it was so, like, party, we're celebrating?
It was very, like, rah-rah girlfriend, and we put on our cool tees, and, you know, all of these people, I get it, we take photos now and selfies, but just people stopping to take photos of all the signs and people holding other people's signs and snapping photos. And my Instagram page was just full of people who went to the march. And I get it. We like to share things. This is what happens now. But it was everyone was having so much fun. And that was confusing for me because I've never gone out to the streets for something because I was happy about it. I mean, maybe in 2008, but every time I've felt the need to go and demonstrate, it's like, oh my gosh, that's horrible. I need to go and let my voice be heard or to show up. So it was just for that reason alone, this sort of party vibe that it had, I found just extremely unfamiliar. And a little, I mean, like, I wasn't happy to be there. I was like, hey, it would have been much better if Donald Trump was not president. We didn't have to do this. So for me, it wasn't like a, oh, goody, we get to go and show up. It was like a, ah, man, I guess we got to go and show this idiot that nobody wants him to be president.
Yeah. What if that party atmosphere is like, you know, the gateway drug? What if it gets some of these people hooked on it and then they are sort of, I don't want to say the word woke, but it's been swirling around in my mind.
Yeah.
And then, so the next time something happens, I mean, this is the best case scenario, right? This is the hope that, like, you know, this is the hope of sort of intersectional feminism, right? That you get all these people in a coalition and then they start to actually understand what the problems are of other people and the way those struggles are related.
Yeah, definitely. And I know that when the Obamas were leaving office, they were both really pushing this message again of like being hopeful. And I think that's kind of where, that's where I would like to be. I would like to hope that this lit the fire under a lot of people and, you know, maybe they did enjoy their protests and maybe now it's something they like doing and they're going to come out and keep doing it. The thing that has me worried is that a lot of the responses that at least I've gotten to my piece have been very defensive. Mm-hmm. And I don't think I was saying protesters are bad people or that they shouldn't have done it. I was saying I was there. I felt a certain type of way watching that happen as a Black woman. And I was trying to figure out why I felt that way. I didn't say it shouldn't have happened. I didn't say, you know, that they were bad people who didn't understand the magnitude of the situation. I said watching that stirred feelings in me, and the defensiveness I've gotten from it, sort of, you know, if you can't accept that a Black woman was at this march that was mostly white with a bunch of people who haven't necessarily had her back or the back of other women of color or other groups of people before, and that I'm a little skeptical, you know, if that's too much for you to just sort of swallow and say, okay, I'm going to do something with that, you know, to me, that is not a good sign. I hope that that is not the consensus, but still slightly worrisome.
Yeah, I hear that.
So the better thing wouldn't be it's like instead of being defensive, because you're not saying it's hopeless, right? Like you're not saying, you know, never will I trust the white women marchers. That's not your message.
No, it was just that I being there, I had a very different experience than others did, mm-hmm. you know, and like, I think the experience, the woohoo girl vibe, like, I get it. I get why those people enjoy themselves. You know, I get why the signs are fun and you're with other women and you're with like-minded people. Like I understand why people enjoyed it. I did not enjoy it for these reasons. And I think that's just as valid as the people who, you know, got their Instagram selfies in.
And one thing I will say, I felt myself feeling defensive, right? And I think it's been useful for me to examine why that is, you know, and if you are feeling defensive, maybe do a self-assessment about that. But I will say I was able to pinpoint exactly what did make me defensive. And there's this sort of trope that, okay, 53% of white women voted for Donald Trump. Remember that, you know, it's probably friends and relatives of yours. And this is exactly where I get defensive because I'm like, well, no one I'm related to voted for Donald Trump. You know, like I didn't vote for Donald Trump. Like, you know, why group me in? And that is precisely like the pressure point for me. And I think probably for a lot of women, it's like, you know, and I do understand that argument that like, if we are in this moment when we're all grouped by our identities, like you got to, you know, think about what your identity is representing in the world. But I think for a lot of women, that is kind of the moment where you're like, well, don't think you know me, you know?
Right. And I mean, it's not a great thing for people to make assumptions off of you based off of the way you look or who you are. And like, I would say that that's something that, you know, a lot of other groups, you know, being up, people make assumptions about me all the time. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't mean it's okay. But I think that learning, there's a different way to deal with it, you know, and I'm sure that if that's not something that you've ever really been faced with before, it probably is a bit of a learning curve because it's not fun, you know, for people to think that you were a part of this bad thing or that you're going to do something bad or that you don't respect certain people or whatever.
Right.
That's a terrible feeling. Lots of other people are faced with even worse assumptions about them on a daily basis.
Totally.
I want to move the discussion a little bit toward, you know, one of the things, Kara, that you focused on was like, okay, what do we do now? We've gathered all over the world. We have, you know, had our moment, whether we found it joyful or difficult or whatever our reaction was, we've millions of women, people around the world have gathered. Now what do we do? And is that the test of whether this was a success, is like what comes out of it? People have said, look, the Tea Party came out of the right-wing protests against Obama's first inauguration. Do any of the people on the call who went to marches, or not on the call, do any of the people, you know, in this discussion have any hopes or any vision of what happens next and what would be a positive outcome beyond just like we had this afternoon of affirmation? Now what happens?
I mean, there was a piece that I linked to in The Guardian, and that writer, he was talking about this idea of protest being the most effective form of resistance to any, you know, one adversary. Mm-hmm. And I think protesting is wonderful, but I also think it's time to consider your own skills, your own abilities, your own resources, and maybe a march isn't the most useful thing that you can do. You know, it was heartening. Over the last couple months, we've seen all of these donations to the ACLU and Planned Parenthood and organizations like that. And I think it's about figuring out what's the best use of your time. Mm-hmm. You know, I would love for everyone to pick up a copy of Civil Disobedience. And if you're working in the government and like you're being told to do certain things, finding your own way to resist things that you know are wrong. So, I mean, protests are wonderful and I think they get the point across, but I don't think it's the be-all and end-all. And, you know, in every situation, that's not what has turned the tides. It's a part of a larger group of activities and group of resistance.
Yeah. I mean, to me, it's like the thing that everyone has to figure out to do is take this sort of activist energy and move it into electoral politics. Mm-hmm. Just like that is what it comes down to. Like people have to put up candidates, they have to vote, they have to vote in local elections, all that good stuff.
Yeah, I mean, there's this organization that I just saw that I immediately signed up for, which is Swing Left. I think that's what it's called. And they're identifying all of the districts and elections in 2018 that have the ability to swing left. And so I will be driving up to Simi Valley or wherever it is and registering people and trying to flip that district. And it's like, that's a thing I could do that probably is more useful than me going out and protesting, because I have the ability to get up there and spend my day doing this in a way that other people don't.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, Kara, it was so awesome to have you on. I hope you'll come on again. Read Kara's story, I Want to Trust the Women's Marchers in Jezebel, and think about what she says.
Thank you so much for having me.
Okay, let's move on to our next topic, why men don't do women's jobs. The latest economic analysis shows an update of what the super fabulous book, The End of Men, already told you so many years ago, which is that the jobs predicted to grow the fastest in the next 10 years are jobs dominated by women, most of them in the health field. So the question we're asking is why men don't adjust. So there is this shift in the economy. Why can't men just make the shift and go over to healthcare, government, teaching jobs, which is where the jobs are in lots of towns? So first of all, let's just like, we're talking about this is a sort of middle class universe we're talking about. These aren't professional class jobs. That's like important to note, right?
I guess it depends how you define middle class. But we're not talking necessarily about jobs that require degrees. Although that seems to be part of the problem, that there seems to be a lack of clarity. Like if you lost your manufacturing job that didn't require, you know, book learning, but required a lot of practical, you know, on the job, you know, essentially an apprenticeship, how do you kind of move to a new, different profession? Because
Well, school is part of the problem. People do, like, if you're, like, I wrote about pharmacists in my book because that's one of those professions that used to not require a lot of school, now requires a huge amount of school, like 6 years. And so it ends up being women who have the patience to go through those 6 years of school, and men don't want to do it. I point out the class things. People always get mad at you. Like, this isn't true in the professional classes. Like, men still do better in a lot of the professional class jobs.
Yeah, I think actually my issue was, like, I never really know quite what we mean by middle class. Like, in England, it has one meaning. In America,
we're all middle class, right? Isn't that what we all believe?
I'm never really sure what we're talking about. But yeah.
Yes.
Is there another way to say that that isn't, like, about middle class? I mean, what kind of jobs are these that we're talking about?
It's mostly like the just explosion of the healthcare industry. I mean, that's another way of talking about this. It's like the decline of industrial labor, the huge amount of healthcare jobs. So if you go to one of these towns that were profiled 80 million times during the campaign, you know, a town, an American town in which there used to be Industry X, there isn't Industry X. People are voting for Trump. What you find in that town is that the only available jobs are healthcare jobs of one kind or another, starting from like home health aid all the way up to, you know, whatever, like working in a hospital, working as a physician's assistant. I mean, it's so funny. I'm doing this story now, and it's in a working class town in Florida. And I interviewed the kids about what they want to be when they grow up. Mm-hmm. And 90% of what they said were healthcare. I want to be a physician's assistant. I want to be, you know, they didn't say home healthcare aid, but it was like the mid-level hospital jobs, because everybody knows already that that's the jobs that are available, but men don't want to do them. So the question is why? Like, what in the UK, June, I was told that nurses, that the word nurse doesn't necessarily bring to mind woman. There are lots of male nurses.
Yeah, I mean, I've lived in this country for more than 30 years, so I'm always a little hesitant to speak for Britain. And my experience of nurses there is really only like when my dad was sick and I went to the hospital. Like, you know, I think like a lot of us, we don't really see the world of medicine until, you know, someone we care about is involved in it. But certainly male nurses, they still are called male nurses in Britain. And there were very few on the wards that I saw. So not to argue with statistics, but I don't know. No, I don't know that that's as obvious or as different as one would think. I think, too, though, that one of the things that's interesting is that there are a lot of medical shows in Britain, and a lot of them have male nurses among the participants or the characters. So I think in that sense, it gives the impression that there are a lot of men in nursing, but I don't know if it's really true.
I think people hate, men who are in nursing hate the term male nurse. Isn't that right? Like,
it's ridiculous. We only ever, you know, use an adjective when we actually have some issues around it, like gay marriage, male nurse. Like, there's as far as I know, there's no difference.
That's a great point.
But
you're just a nurse. Yeah. I mean, part of this is like bad. Like, part of this is a problem where when women flood a profession, the profession becomes less worthy.
Right.
That phenomenon is still alive and well. You know, if it's a profession dominated by women, like teaching and nursing, there seems to be a ceiling on the prices. So it's not, you know, merely that men are just being irrational or don't want to go to school. It's that, or that there's a cultural and social stigma, all of which I think are true. It's also that they're seen as dead endish because they are full of women. That's still true.
Well, but also I think that it counteracts men's identity in the United States, right? If you're a man, you don't necessarily think of yourself as caring, as you know, all of these adjectives that we use to describe. We want our nurses to be gentle. We want them to be kind. We want them to be thoughtful. And I'm not saying that there are not tons and tons of men out there, but I think that's not what society trains men to think of as their most important, most marketable skills. And so there was this very interesting article in the New York Times a week or two ago about how the language that's used to advertise these jobs is so important. And when those words are used, you know, kind, caring, men don't think it's a job for them. When the people advertising the jobs talk about the adrenaline rush of, you know, working in a hospital, then men are like, okay, I could do that. Or, you know, if the language is gender neutral, there's a really marked statistical difference in how many men actually go for those jobs.
Here's the thing, though. The I think the job that was in the lead of the story that you're talking about, Noreen, was actually a home healthcare aide, which is an extraordinarily low paying job. Tends to be something where you have to run around, like an ex of mine's mother was one, and she basically spent her entire life working or traveling to a job because you have to travel there, which she had to do on the bus. You get there and it's a short thing, then you move on to another home. Like it pays terribly because it's a very basic caregiving job in the way that looking after people's kids pays terrible, even though it's hugely important. And so I think people really do want somebody who's caring. Those things, it's not just an advertising issue. People are seriously desiring that the person who comes into their home for their vulnerable family member right. should actually be really caring and patient and kind. And it would be a miracle if they were given this nature of their job that they're essentially run ragged for no money. But, you know, and there is an issue, I think, something that's very hard to talk about that very few of the articles that we read talked about, that people don't really necessarily want a guy, a strange man, even if he's has some kind of nursing qualification in their home, in the way that they feel comfortable, kind of, or can make themselves feel comfortable with a woman. And that's really extra hard because that's based on stereotypes too. But I kind of feel that way myself. I understand that on a visceral level.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, there is a lot of emotional labor involved in being a nurse. You know, there's actually a ton of technical skill, of course, mm-hmm. too. But, mm-hmm. You know, people, when you're in the doctor's office, you're nervous, probably. A lot of people are. And you want someone who's reassuring, who feels like a person I'm going to totally stereotype doctors, but sometimes I find doctors are like too busy to like look you in the eye. And, you know, we sort of look to nurses to be that person. And you know, we live in a society where we discount emotional labor. And this is
exactly.
But a lot of women end up doing jobs with emotional labor as a huge component of them.
Yeah, we undervalue and underpay caregiving generally. And the lower down the sort of qualification scale, the more it essentially is caregiving in a way that, it is all the way to the top, so to speak. But there's more, you know, the breakdown between caregiving and technical nursing, I think, changes a lot the lower down the qualification scale you get.
Mm-hmm.
And those are the places where you're usually alone with the patient.
So, Noreen, you have a friend who's a man and a nurse.
Yeah.
Yeah. So let's call him up and see what he faced along the way, how he feels about it, if he feels like people stereotype him, if there's any stigma, just to get a sense of what it is like to be that person.
So this is my friend Avi Zendelman, who used to be a journalist and a few years ago decided to leave journalism entirely and become a nurse. Avi, hi.
Hi.
So tell us, what made you decide to become a nurse?
Well, mainly I became a nurse because I was a journalist and I really didn't like writing. And the second reason I became a nurse was because this is what they kind of tell you to both write in your essay when you apply to nursing school and to say something else besides that, because I wanted to help people.
Mm. And did you feel like people kind of cocked their eyes and said, what, when you said when you said you were becoming a nurse because of your gender, or what was the reaction?
Yeah, everyone kind of looked a little bit strange. Well, not everyone, but it wasn't the normal thing for a political journalist to go decide to do.
What percent would you say were men in your nursing class?
So this is my favorite thing. At nursing school, they're always like, you know, the number of men in nursing has tripled in the past, like, 20 or 30 years. So instead of just me in my class at nursing school, it was me, Matt, and Kevin. It's gone from, like, 3% to 10%. And that kind of reflected the reality.
Did you get any of the – were people tiptoeing around it carefully? Like, were people careful not to call you male nurse or not to make you feel like I'm trying to in my imagination, you're like the stay-at-home dad at the park where the moms like carefully like tiptoe around the fact that you're a man. Like, how did people treat
you? No, it was always more like we walk into the room and we're like, yay, there are men here.
Oh, so they were happy about it.
Like, there was my favorite thing was it was assumed that everyone knew how to sew on the patch for nursing school. And but there wasn't stuff that was really the only stuff that was ever no one ever felt bad about calling you a male nurse. I mean, they'll just call you a nurse or they'll go for the guys in the room or for the men in the room, you know, don't blow out your back. But there's like,
wait, what do you mean?
So most of the time there'd be these occasional sides when we were getting taught. So there would be like, men, don't still ask for help if you have to lift a person in bed. You don't want to blow out your back.
Oh.
This is something we tell to all of the guy nurses.
Okay.
Or if you're putting a catheter in a woman's urethra and you accidentally put it into the vagina, there's two different holes. Make sure to bring a second tube to put in there.
How do your patients react to you differently as a man than if you were a woman?
So this is interesting. The first time I did yes and no, I occasionally get called doc by patients, and I kind of feel like I'm the Affleck duck. I go, not a doctor. I will occasionally just get called doc over and over and over again by a patient. And one time there was this doctor who the patient – well, actually, let me be clear. The patient's husband kept on asking me what I thought, and I kept on redirecting back to the doctor. And then the other thing is occasionally there will be like – patients will be like, no, I want a woman to wash me. And I'll be like, well, I'm your nurse, although my first probably – few months, I would just go and get a female nurse to go and do it. And if they're really opposed to it, or there's a warning beforehand that like patient really prefers female nurses, then we'll get around it.
I mean, is that how much does that come up? Because I was just saying before we called you that there are certain areas where there is a kind of a vulnerability, you know, of a female patient and a male nurse, not necessarily in a hospital setting, but in maybe in home health kinds of settings. Is there training about that? Are there, you know, is there guidance around how you can, you know, reduce those feelings of concern, or how is that treated?
Yeah, I mean, so firstly, there is the, we are taught the language of caring and the heart, head, heart sandwich. when we communicate with people to offset any discomfort. But the other thing is if you ever have to do a real vaginal exam, and we don't do that because we're not doctors, you always have to bring in like a female chaperone.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, we're not spending our day doing the most vulnerable things all the time to the patient. And, you know, there is some level of common sense that you – if a patient is clearly uncomfortable, you maybe bring someone else in the room, or you say, you know, let me know if you feel uncomfortable. Your job is to let me know if you're feeling uncomfortable. Otherwise, we can't know if anything's going wrong with you. And part of it is just creating a kind of safe, open environment and, like, letting them know if they feel uncomfortable, they can always communicate out.
Right.
I would say, and I remember the first time I was in an OBGYN floor, it was a labor and delivery floor, and this was my first time on the floor, and I was like terrified of going into the room and me just kind of mucking around there and women being offended. So I'd go in and ask, and every time the husband was in the room, I was told, no, you can't do it. If the husband wasn't in the room, they'd kind of shrug and like be appreciative that I had asked.
Avi, this is a very invasive question, but we're friends, so I feel like I can ask you this. Do you feel like it's changed your identity, like as a man, and the way you see yourself since you've become a nurse?
Yes and no. I mean, so one of the reasons, and this is kind of the once I committed to being a nurse, right? Given my environment was among kind of people with like silly, fancy degrees and journalists and people who did politics, it was already kind of a half contrarian thing to do. So I had already pre-committed to do that. I think the thing where my identity has changed is I have spent now probably the last 5 or so years in an environment that is 85 to 95% women all the time. And to some degree, that just shapes how you see everything, being A, the kind of either the lone man in a room, or B, when you're in an environment that was anywhere from like 40 to 80% male, you suddenly start to see it. And then when you also say, I'm a nurse, I do say, sorry, that sometimes I will say, you know, instead of saying, I'm a nurse, I'll like let my voice go down 2 octaves as a kind of, I'm like having to, feeling like I need to reassert my manliness.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
What about in dating? Does that, is it a thing?
I mean, in dating, so I should note that for 3 years when I was in nursing school, I was also living in my parents' basement. So I've only have about a year of disaggregating the two. I mean, I have a lot of theories about this, none of which are actually probably valid, but I do think that it can sometimes be slightly counted against you. There's always a little bit of a hint of why aren't you a doctor with some people, but otherwise I think it's common enough or the type of person that's already going on a date with me that's like kind of baked into the cake already.
Okay, here is my last big question. So there's this thing in this country where there are certain towns where you would say men should become nurses because those are the relatively high-paying jobs available.
Yep.
But there's a kind of stigma to becoming a nurse. What would you say? This is your national responsibility to turn this problem around. Avi, so what would
so
you like? What would
I'll
you say?
I'll tell you what I tell every 4-year-old boy who comes into the hospital. I go, "You should become a nurse because you get to listen to farts all day."
Okay, America. Did you
say,
hear that?
I will actually also say the place where I've got the kind of least amount of skepticism about being a nurse has actually been when I've been talking to people from rural areas, and they're like, "Oh yeah, we need nurses. I've got a cousin who's a nurse." I think also a lot of the stigma comes not from nursing, but actually the slightly lower paying jobs like home health aides and others, and those jobs that pay maybe $10 an hour and not a nursing, like a classic nursing job, which usually pays between, you know, 55 and 80 grand a year.
Right, which is a totally respectable salary.
But yeah, you get to listen to farts all day. Everyone should do it.
Everyone should do it. All right. Well, Avi, thank you so much for coming on today. This was awesome. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, gals.
Bye.
Thanks.
Thank you, Avi.
All right. Our final topic. A recent poll of Americans shows that most people think it's a better time to be a man than a woman, with one exception, Republican men, who say women have it better. That is interesting and bizarre that people would think that. And it's essentially a misreading of the world, I think. I believe so. Noreen, what did you think? Didn't you find that? That's just such a surprising result, and it tells you so much.
Yes. I think it explains some things about the election, actually. So my one thought about this is that I feel like it reflects I don't remember what the mathematical term is, but it's like it reflects the movement of change, like basically the current has turned, right? So they see their status relative to the world going down. It's still, you know, to be a white man in America is still probably the easiest thing to be in America. But they see people pushing against that. They see it being slightly less, you know, a position of privilege than it used to be. And they magnify those losses. And that becomes the only thing that they can see, perhaps. Also, you know, they're to give them a little bit of genuine sympathy, in our earlier segment, we talked about how all these jobs are going away. Okay. Mm-hmm. So there is a real sense of loss in economic terms.
So I'm going to read a quote in a story by Claire Kane Miller, who is authoring a lot of really interesting gender stories in the New York Times. This is by a retired police captain in Pennsylvania. It's a lot of the PC stuff. He says it's easier being a woman today than a man. The white man is the low person on the totem pole. Everybody else is above the white man, you know, and everyone in general is in favor of a woman. So it's this sense in the Michael Kimmel book, Angry White Men, he kind of described this attitude, that it's this combination of a feeling of entitlement and a loss of a certain social status. And what that like dangerous brew leads up to is basically misogyny. It's like we used to have this place. We deserve this place. We've always had this place. We don't exactly have this place anymore, but we deserve it. You know, we should be there. And so what you wind up with is a lot of resentment. I mean, not just towards women, also towards people of color, but towards women, like a feeling that they have sort of drifted into becoming the enemy.
Yeah. I mean, I think change is difficult for most people, and for some of us more difficult than others because of personality or because of privilege. But it does seem it's striking that men are willing to just say out loud that for, you know, an 81-year-old guy who in that story said men are always at fault. And I know in a way what he's talking about. I'm sure that it is.
It's like the sitcom version. Like, yeah, exactly. The dad didn't do it right.
Yeah, exactly. And I know, I'm sure that's no fun, but it's also a reaction to change rather than the real situation, I think. Men, you know, it's like we're talking about change. Therefore, the people whose position or whose access or whatever is changing most are white men. Therefore, if you happen to be this particular 81-year-old white guy, your response to that is to say, man, everyone's just blaming men.
And you don't feel especially privileged. Like if you're a working class white guy, you're not feeling privileged. Exactly. You feel like your whole world is being taken away from you. So this idea of people saying, oh, white privilege, it doesn't make sense to you in terms of your like emotional configuration or your actual, say, job situation. Because the reality is, as the topic we discussed previously, men and women are not competing for the same jobs. There's a huge amount of gender segregation in the workplace. So, you know, men are not trying to be nurses and teachers, and women are not, you know, they are more trying to be police captains than the other way around. You know, more women take traditional men's jobs than men take traditional female jobs. But it's not really like an active competition for the same space.
Yeah.
It's just that you feel like, what are you people? Me, privileged? Like, what are you talking about?
Exactly.
Like, I can't even get a damn job.
Exactly. When people are very anxious about employment and pensions and healthcare and all those really basic things and even, you know, keeping their homes, it's very hard to hear terms like privilege and to accept that, you know, a certain view of the world, which is definitely real, sees that they have more than some other groups. So, it's a really hard message to respond to well.
And one way in which I do think we have life better than men is that I think sort of male identity is so prescribed in this country. Mm-hmm. And that can probably feel shackling, right? Whereas women of sort of up and down the socioeconomic ladder, we have a little more flexibility. Yeah. I mean, this is totally like an end of men argument, Hannah, but you're a little better equipped to navigate a changing world as a woman. There are certainly a lot of expectations of women, but in some ways there are fewer expectations, which is freeing.
Well, being an underdog makes you flexible. I mean, that's part of why women are more flexible. Stephanie Kuntz, who, you know, she writes a lot of fabulous New York Times op-eds about men and women and work and sociology, and she wrote that great book about marriage. She devised this term, the masculine mystique. She wrote an op-ed about this a couple of years back. And the idea was, you know, if the feminine mystique, the Betty Friedan book, was this idea that women had been kind of wedged into this really narrow role, which wasn't serving them well, which didn't allow them to express their talents or participate in society, that now men are in that same position where the traditional definitions of masculinity are kind of suffocating them, are not allowing them to kind of navigate the world as it is today, move around, express themselves in all the ways that they would like to, that we're still stuck, you know. And I've always wondered if, you know, yes, traditionally over the last 100 years, women have been more flexible, have moved into new roles, new ways of dressing, new ways of being. Whether it's just a lag, like men will get, you will be able to be, you know, a nurse or be more feminine or stay at home with your kids, or if the masculine stereotypes are just much stronger and more constricting than the feminine ones.
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't know. I'm thinking back to something that we read about when we were researching. You know, the story of what we'll just call male nurses, that one of the problems that that sociologists identified with men who had been displaced and were having trouble kind of finding a new perch for themselves was that they were looking for the job you used to have. You know, that in many ways, there's not just the job that they're looking for. They're looking for the place they used to have. They're looking for the voice they used to have. And I understand it, you know, as somebody who doesn't have that, I'm ready for change, but I totally get where they're coming from. But let's just look at that study though, because for all of understanding, it is really striking that there are certain things that men seem to have some kind of, I don't say wrong ideas about, because that's privileging my own idea, but like just the way they talked about, for example, feelings of safety, physical safety that women might experience. There were, a good deal less than how women, position themselves as sometimes are often feeling unsafe. In terms of how often women felt that they were being judged as sex objects, or being subjected to sexist language or feeling treated with less respect, the numbers were much less with how women felt that they experienced that and how much men thought that women experienced that. So there is definitely a big bubble, as we've been calling it in recent months, experience that men have, that they, you know, just like we all have a problem of empathy, that men's empathy for women's situation seems very challenged.
That was depressing in that survey, is how little the men seem to see the perspective of the women. Mm-hmm. I don't know who's, correct,
right,
statistically
right,
speaking
right,
about women's safety, but they really seem to underplay, any feelings of insecurity, sexism in the workplace, harassment, or even just success in the workplace or job success that women were feeling. It was just like they have it better than we have it.
Come on, women are just getting given men's jobs these days.
Yeah, exactly. I'm about to be promoted to police captain any day. All right. So should we move on to recommendations?
Yes, let's.
June, why don't you go first?
I have two because I was away last episode. So I always listen to podcasts before I go to sleep. But the last like 3, maybe even 4 weeks, I've been off my usual podcast diet because I've been obsessed with this iTunes University course, which is basically, they just pull together like university courses that have been recorded. And I paid rapt attention to this one from Yale called Early Modern England, Politics, Religion and Society. It's by a history professor, Keith Wrightson, and it's totally fascinating. It's like the most fascinating thing I have heard or read or experienced in a very long time. It's sort of the story of British history from like the Tudors to the Restoration. I learned things about Scottish nationalism and just the backstory about that. It's really, really good. The guy doesn't get distracted as a lot of those professors do. It's not about him. So I really recommend it completely and wholly. I also just want to mention that the BBC iPlayer radio service is now available as an app in the United States. So you've always been able to listen to BBC radio legally. You could listen to it on your desktop. And there were some apps that made it possible. But the iPlayer for radio is now completely openly available in the US. You can listen to amazing BBC shows, radio shows, either live or on a delay or somewhere available for download. And both if you're into music, it's great. I listen to plays and documentaries and newscasts, and it's just fantastic. And now it is so much easier to access.
Wow, June, that That was a lot of knowledge. That's great.
Thank you.
No, seriously. Those are things I didn't know. That sounds great. All right. Well, mine are so lowbrow, given the state of our nation and the importance of what went down this week. I apologize for that, because actually what I think we should be doing is directing people to maybe we'll figure this out for ourselves for the next show, directing people to places that are going on that are channeling the activism from the march. That would be a more useful thing than the thing that I'm about to do, because truly the thing that gave me the most pleasure this week is the video, The Netherlands Welcomes Donald Trump, which was maybe the funniest thing I've ever seen. It's like the John Oliver equivalent from the Netherlands, who did this video basically saying hello to Donald Trump, and it's just so good. And then Peaky Blinders, which is a British produced series that's on Netflix about an Irish gang around the time of World War One, and it is fabulous.
I've always meant to watch it, but I haven't, because it's set in Birmingham, which sets itself up as Britain's second city, when it's a well-known fact that my city, Manchester, is Britain's second city. So in protest, I haven't watched it yet.
How many things have you not done because of that? Okay, Noreen, you.
I really love the movie 20th Century Women. It's just so sweet and tender. It's the story of a woman who is divorced. She's an older mother in Santa Barbara in the late 70s, and she has a teenage son. And it's sort of, he is becoming an adolescent before her eyes, or a grown up before her eyes. And, you know, her figuring out how to raise a boy, essentially. And she grew up during the Depression, and her son loves punk, and she's open-minded, and yet she just doesn't think punk is good. Like, she goes to a punk show and she's like, well, I don't know. And it's just really sweet and funny, and I can't recommend it enough.
I hear Annette Bening is amazing.
Annette Bening is amazing. She's really great.
Okay. So that's our recommendations. No, I really want to see it. It's gotten just really great reviews, and I really want to see it. So I shall. Thanks to our producer, Jordan Bell, this week. The executive producer of Slate Podcast is Steve Lickteig. Andy Bowers is the chief content officer of the Panoply Network, and our wonderful intern, Daniel Schrader. The XX Gabfest is part of the Panoply Network. Check out the entire roster of podcasts at itunes.com/panoply, our show page, slate.com/XX, to read our recommendations and find out more information about the show, or our Facebook page, facebook.com/XXGabFest, to post responses, post pictures of your sign, anything else you want to say about the march, and to recommend things that we should talk about. Or you can email us, XXGabFest@slate.com, or subscribe on iTunes and leave a comment so other people can find out about the show. For June and Irene, I'm Hannah motherfucking Rosen.